You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a production of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and today I'm very pleased to welcome Aaron Wren back to the show. Aaron is one of the preeminent thinkers on the Midwest region, focusing on urban areas and economic development, infrastructure, and all things that will help make the region thrive in the 21st century. He was formerly with the Manhattan Institute in New York City. He's now based in Indianapolis. He writes regularly for one of the best magazines covering local government issues. That's Governing Magazine. I'm really pleased to have him on the show today. Aaron, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I've read some of your work recently, and I thought it would be worth a discussion here with our listeners in the Quad Cities region on what you're thinking as our economy emerges from, of course, the COVID pandemic and resulting economic damage that was done over the past little over a year. Some interesting things going on, and some of your writing talks about those and the different approaches states are taking to get their economies going again. We'll cover a lot of ground today, but you wrote recently about partly about, again, our red state, blue state divide and some of the red state strategies that seem to be maybe lacking a little bit. And we'll talk here about the blue states as well, but share with our listeners kind of the central theme of your latest article in Governing Magazine.
Sure. Well, what you see is, you know, red states, kind of the conservative approach to economic development and governance has basically been limited government, cut spending, low taxes, low regulation, et cetera. The idea is we just create this place that doesn't burden businesses, then, you know, jobs, investment will flow in and we'll have prosperity. And that approach seems to have worked relatively well, and I think we question the nuances of what the actual public policies were, but that approach seems to have worked well in places like Texas, Tennessee, or Florida. But when you start getting into some of these northern states, northern red states like Kansas and Indiana, we see that they've been implementing these sorts of things, but they didn't really work. So Kansas had this pretty radical tax rollback under Governor Sam Brownback. They also cut spending in education, foster care, and, you know, many other areas. And, you know, it did not trigger an economic boom. You know, their job growth has badly trailed the nation, and it did create a fiscal crisis for the state. And so they were forced to, you know, essentially roll back most of those tax cuts just to get the budget back in order. Indiana, similarly, you know, it's been Republican controlled completely for over a decade. But if you look back, you see that, the state's per capita incomes as a share of the national average has been declining. Over half the state's population, counties are losing population. Workforce is projected to be in decline almost everywhere. And, you know, they will talk about the fact that they're, you know, growing in population and jobs faster than Illinois or some other surrounding slow growth states. But that's sort of a low hurdle to jump. I mean, this is not like, again, it's not a Tennessee, it's not a Texas, it's not an Idaho. It's, you know, a place that's essentially becoming a low-end economy. And, you know, it has not produced, you know, essentially, you know, great economic results for the state, particularly in incomes, which have, you know, declined relative to the nation under Republican leadership. So I think we see, you know, that they've had control and have been implementing their policies. And, you know, in my view, it has not produced especially good results. Not terrible results, but certainly not great results.
Well, why is this important for our listeners? Because we're right here in a region with states on either side of us that are completely different in their approaches. Iowa's a red state, probably in a lot of ways similar to the approaches Kansas and Indiana's taking, but Illinois is a blue state. you've talked a little bit about the red state approach. What's the general blue state approach? Just to give equal time here, you're not enamored with that as either, I would imagine.
Yeah, well, you know, the blue states, it depends on where you are, but, you know, blue states tend to have higher taxes. They tend to have much higher regulation, much higher government spending. And, you know, they essentially are channeling their money to all of their favorite groups. And to the extent that you're in a city that is home to, you know, some type of high-end economy, you're doing quite well. Just as there are red states that are doing quite well, there are some, blue states that are doing quite well. Again, or regions of blue states that are doing pretty well. Washington State's doing pretty well. You know, the Bay Area has been very successful in high tech. New York City did well with finance. You know, Boston with, you know, biotechnology and its educational complex there. So if you happen to have, like, a fortress industry in some high-value environment, in your blue area, you're doing pretty well. But if you are, you do not have, you know, Silicon Valley or Wall Street or the federal government or something like that, then you see that these areas, you know, tend to be very stagnant as well. You know, I used to live in Rhode Island, which is a blue state, extremely economically stagnant, despite, you know, having, you know, a lot of proximity to Boston and other things. Some of the areas of these blue states, like the Central Valley of California, are also incredibly high poverty. You know, California, tent cities popping up all over the state. So, I'm not saying that this blue state model, has really worked well. I'm not arguing for a particular model of blue state governance. I just want to shine the light on where some of these, red state government policies have not produced results in certain contexts.
What should they be focusing on? And you mentioned some census data, you know, population loss, poverty rates. What is like the gold standard of census data like that you look at that shows an area doing well, and what policies do you see in your work that are going to bring those things about?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a lot of different ways to measure success, but I think you should look at some measure of, you know, quantitative, qualitative growth, and, you know, some measure of inclusivity. So quantitative would be, are you growing? Are you adding people? Are you adding jobs? Qualitative would be, are your per capita incomes increasing relative to the nation? Is your per capita GDP increasing relative to the nation? And then some measure of inclusion, right? Is this an equitable growth, or is it, you know, San Francisco getting all the gains and, you know, other parts of your state getting all the losses? I would argue that, economic growth is very complex. It can't be reduced to simple formulas like invest in this or cut that. A lot of it is historic factors, geographic factors. One thing I argue, for example, is if you look at these Sun Belt places, one of the things they have is, well, the sun. You know, median January temperature has been the biggest predictor of state-level population growth since 1960, or at least that stat was true as of years ago. And so, you know, there are factors like natural amenities, or the fact that you have, you know, MIT, or certain historical factors that play a role, cultural factors play a role. It is very complex. I don't want to suggest that there's a very simple way that governments in Kansas or Indiana or Illinois could just turn a few dials and flip a few switches, and everything's going to start going, you know, perfectly. But what I would say is I want to take a little bit of a mindset shift, particularly in red states, which is to go from saying, look, we want to be a business-friendly state, which pretty much all of them shout, to saying we want to be a citizen-friendly state. And the idea is, how do we focus on improving the lives of the people who live here today, which does have an economic development perspective, but also has, you know, other perspectives as well. And, you know, there's a professor, his name escapes me, down at the University of Virginia. He's a, you know, left-wing law professor. But his approach on local government, he's very much into having strong local control in states, for cities and localities. His view was, we don't know what causes economic growth. It's sort of a mystery. And given that it's sort of a mystery and we don't know, why wouldn't we implement the policies that we think are going to be best for the people who live here? So he's advocating things like increasing the minimum wage, for example. I'm not necessarily saying go increase the minimum wage, but I think things that tune the balance in favor of citizens, you know, as opposed to, you know, businesses that are not necessarily being very good to the citizens, not necessarily business in general, I think is a good one. So in Indiana, for example, the Indianapolis Star, the main newspaper in Indianapolis, did an expose showing horrific conditions in a lot of rental properties. So the city passed an ordinance that, you know, required landlords to give tenants a copy of their rights. I mean, it didn't actually create any new rights. It just said, look, you have the right to have, you know, functional plumbing, safe electricity, it works, et cetera. I mean, this was the absolute basis. It's embarrassing. What happens, you know, the landlord, property owner's lobby goes straight to the state legislature and gets it preempted. So in essence, the state of Indiana has said, we are pro-slumlord, anti-citizen. And too many of their decisions are made on that basis, where the worst sorts of parasitic, you know, industries, firms are, you know, rewarded and the state rolls out the red carpet for them. But if something actually affects the life of the citizens, such as the quality of a rental property, ensuring you have high quality rental properties, or at least ones that aren't, you know, slums and unsafe to live in, they just have no interest in that. And unfortunately, that is the common way that a lot of these red states think. It's like, we have to, you know, this is how they've tuned the balance of their policy making, and I think it's a big mistake. So quite apart from, you know, whether it will cause any jobs added to the state or grow the economy at all, I just think you want to be thinking, hey, we want to make sure that people who are renting properties have a safe place to live with heat, functional plumbing, et cetera, and they can't be abused by slumlords. That's just a basic function of government that they don't want to carry out.
It seems to me, and I don't know if you'd agree, but both red and blue states seem to, when issues arise, turn immediately to the ideological playbook. Instead of maybe seeking what maybe a common sense middle of the road solution is that may not lend itself to a left or right definition. I don't know. Maybe that's hoping for too much, but is that kind of what you see in governments, state governments across the country?
Most state governments seem to have a lot of special interest control. So in a blue state like Illinois, the public employee unions, for example, are going to be a very large and powerful constituency. So we just saw in Illinois, here's a state that's bankrupt, and they passed a pension sweetener for Chicago firefighters. Anyway, it's like insane. Well, in these red states, special interests tend to be things like low-wage manufacturing businesses and the like. So, you know, I would distinguish between these sort of bespoke single industry or single group lobbies and more general business lobbies like chambers of commerce, which if you look at, you know, if you look at the agenda, right, of the, say, the Chicagoland Chamber of Commerce or any big chambers of commerce, they actually tend to be pretty sane and actually often are suggesting more investment in public goods and services. But when you get into, for example, you know, the apartment lobby or the, you know, the small manufacturers groups, or, you know, the casinos, or the payday loan industry, you know, or the nursing homes. These little, you know, each little industry, you know, seems to have a very powerful pull in a lot of these red states, and some of them are industries, quite frankly, that, you know, I would think you could use a little less casino industry.
For yeah.
You know, we could use a smaller payday loan industry. But that's certainly not how how they think about it, and but I think a lot of special interests basically dominate, and it's sort of gussied up in sort of ideological propositions. So you preempt an ordinance that protects tenants, and you say you're being pro-business or limited government or something like that. You claim that you want consistency, and there's a lot of little things you can say. I think it's sort of gussied up ideologically. But a lot of it's just straight up cronyism. And, you know, you see that on display in Illinois for sure. But it's on display, I think, in most states, whether red or blue. Tremendous cronyism.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. This is your host, Robin Johnson. I'm with my guest today, Aaron Wren, who formerly with the Manhattan Institute. He's now a consultant and writer based in Indianapolis, Indiana. We've been talking a little bit about the post-COVID economy. Aaron, somebody that I watch quite a bit. I've got a group of people I watch, regardless of party, ideology, or whatever, just because they're smart. They write provocative things about the economy and what's going on in our region. And we've been talking a little bit about the economy here in the Midwest as it emerges from the COVID pandemic. Aaron, I wanted to kind of switch gears a little bit here and talk about the global economy. I know we've had a lot of discussions. I've seen you at a couple of events dealing with globalization in the Midwest. And it seems like COVID has kind of tapped the brakes a little bit about on globalization. Do you think that's going to continue? Is it going to be slowed up, reversed a little bit, or is it going to continue to steam ahead as it certainly was before the pandemic?
Yeah, it's really hard to say. Certainly there has been some kind of decline in what you might call global trade and migration during the pandemic. Some just for flat out health reasons. I think we are going to see some look at supply chains in some areas, due to, chip shortages in the auto industries and things of that nature. And I'm not expecting a fundamental shift in the nature of some of these global invasion. I mean, it's hard to say, but I don't think this is going to be like a mass reshoring, for example. Part of it just depends on, how things play out with the incentive structures of the people who actually have, power and influence in our society, how that goes. For example, you look at the universities, they are all, extremely dependent on high tuition being paid by foreign students in order to help balance their budgets. So there's a very, very powerful lobby for expansive visa policy bringing over students. For example, traditionally, I think a lot of the, business communities and these lobbies would have been very pro-globalization because they would have seen it as their interest. Now, there is some increasing skepticism towards China that you can probably detect. There seems to be something of a change in the kind of governing class to become a little more China hawkish. I think that's one aspect of the Trump administration that is not going to be reversed by Biden. So I do think there's going to be much more skepticism towards China in particular. But whether that means, a big diminution in globalization, it's really hard to see that in the cards at this time. Obviously I think that, the Midwest, there's certainly been some trends in that direction in terms of, declining international immigration in Chicago and places like that. But, it'll probably vary from place to place what the impact will be. It's a little hard to predict, I guess I'd say.
Yeah, the reason I asked and bring that up is just because I've seen some reports that our economy is almost back to where it was pre-COVID as far as total GNP, I believe it was, economic growth. However, the number of jobs aren't. That's still below where we were. And the question is was productivity enhancements developed, technology to that kind of COVID forced on many employers in a way? They've done that, and now the jobs aren't coming back, and it leads right to some of the issues we had before that led politically to the populist movement in Trump's election. What are your thoughts on that? I mean, will our economy get back to the employment level it was pre-COVID? Are you seeing that? And I know you're not an economist, but I know you talked to a lot of people dealing with this. But what are you seeing?
The big shift with COVID that I see, there are a couple. One is that it definitely shifted the, balance of power ever greater in favor of the large established corporations. So, the Targets, the Walmarts, the Amazons, the tech companies, the Zooms, big tech companies and large corporations, other than some in the retailing sector and a few others, really are going to have become increasingly dominant. There were a lot of small business failures, by contrast. So I think we've seen, acceleration of this trend towards the kind of large corporate or tech domination of many sectors of the economy. I do think we'll also see some, I don't want to claim, how large it will be, but there will be some, accelerated shift towards remote work and location flexibility. This is something that was already happening pre-COVID. Back in 2000, I think about 3.5% of workers were worked from home, and that was up, over 2 percentage points since then, and that was even pre-COVID up through 2019. So now we're more people were working from home pre-COVID than were taking public transit to work nationally. And so that's going to, up the challenge for Midwestern communities to become more desirable places to live because you can't necessarily rely on the employer to bring someone in. I think increasingly today, in a lot of these second-tier markets, what you're going to see is these large employers are going to say, look, I know you don't want to move to Kansas City for this job. You would rather stay wherever you're at. So we will let you work remotely. And so the talent flows that may have come from recruiting, it's going to be a more difficult sell. So the importance of place, attractiveness of place individuals is going to be increasingly important. And probably, both of those trends are negative towards the heartland. Many of the heartland companies that are here are sort of legacy, kind of call them legacy companies. The emerging power companies are in tech and other places. And then this is a place that was already sort of out of favor residentially. And so those are sort of the areas I think it's going to be important to work on.
It sounds like bigness is going to be a key factor here in the near term. Bigger cities, bigger companies. Is that your take? What's your prognosis for small business and smaller communities?
Small business is always going to be with us, but the trend certainly has been towards, bigger companies, consolidation in industries. If you go back to, even the 1980s and look at the landscape of a fragmented banking market in America, fragmented, retail landscape, fragmented utility landscape, we've had tremendous consolidation nationally already. There's been a lot written on this. And so that was a trend that was already out there and seems to be increasing, for a lot of reasons. But one of them is that, public policy has favored it. And so, unless there's some sort of a big turn towards antitrust in Washington, I don't see, an imminent reversal of that.
So your focus, as I mentioned at the outset, is on cities. You're an urban expert mostly, but you're also an expert on the Midwest region. But I wanted to ask you, for our area, the Quad Cities, it's kind of it's not a suburbs close into big cities, but it is out here, and it is a major metro region. What would you advise city leaders in our Quad City region about what they should be doing to lay the groundwork for future growth coming out of our COVID pandemic?
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's about, again, providing basic public services, basic public goods and services, parks, policing and public safety, having your roads there, having good governance, low corruption, funding, making sure that you're not taking on too much debt, accruing too many unfunded pensions, taking care of a lot of the basics, and again, focusing on what you can do to improve the life of your citizens. I don't know the Quad Cities well, but to the extent that you do have, assets that are, unique and relevant to the knowledge economy, looking for ways to leverage them, trying to make sure you're a place that's welcoming to newcomers when they come, which is something that a lot of Midwestern cities struggle with, things of that nature. I think the challenge for guys is, you look at Illinois. Illinois is such a Chicago-centric state in terms of how everything is run. I mean, pretty much all the power players have been from Chicago. It's so demographically dominant. they can sort of impose their will on the rest of the state because the other communities don't necessarily get a lot of love. And again, in Iowa, you're not the largest region either. And so I think there's kind of a challenge of thinking about kind of within the landscapes of states, you know, how do you get attention from the state? How do you carve out a niche? Kind of in the world, what's your niche? I don't necessarily think trying to become a huge growth story is necessary for a lot of places, but the idea of how can we become a better place to live for the people who already live here is something I would be thinking about.
Final question. We got about a minute here. I know you, one of the things too that you pointed out in that article is cities and states also just keep using these incentive packages to lure companies in. That's not really something that's would be at the top of your list for how cities can produce some job growth.
You know, I'm realistic that the incentive game is one you sort of have to play. I mean, it just is. You know, unilaterally disarming on incentives, unless you are, say, in New York City, you know, or San Francisco, is just probably not going to work. And every mayor or governor needs to brag about how many new jobs they've bagged from these deals. And so, I know there's some of that is going to happen, but try to limit the insane giveaways to as much as possible. And then don't make that the sole way that you go about trying to attract business and people. I think you need to also focus maybe much more so on how do we help the companies that we already have grow. If I have a small business that could grow, how can it become a medium-sized business? How can we help our medium-sized businesses expand? How can we help new entrepreneurs get started in our community? Most jobs are not going to come as a result of big game hunting or smokestack chasing from economic development. But what can you do to create an environment locally where maybe many of the people you already have can grow?
If you're interested in learning more about Aaron Wren, you can go to his website. It's aaronwren.com. That's AaronRenn.com. Again, he's an expert on urban areas in the Midwest, with a focus on the Midwest. And I think our listeners will find his work very interesting and very relevant to our times. So, Aaron, I want to thank you again for being our guest, and I look forward to having you back. It's always a stimulating conversation.
Thanks for having me.
Heartland Politics is a production of WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can hear more on the Heartland Politics podcast, available at wvik.org, in the WVIK app, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.